Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
And this is Dan Abuhoff.
With Tamsin and Dan Read the Paper. Okay, so it's Sunday, July 9th, 2017.
That's right.
Hot summer day. Nice day.
Nice.
Beautiful day.
Yes.
And we're in back in downtown Limeport.
Yes, it is.
With our report. We're going to start out today with the museum update. Ding, 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 ding.
Yes,
go ahead. There's an exhibition at the Morgan Library.
Yes, and Tamsin's going to talk for a few minutes about the Morgan Library and come back to the particular exhibit a little later in the podcast.
Well, the exhibition that caught my eye is Henry James, an American Painting. Okay, and it's at the Morgan Library. Do you know the Morgan Library? Have you ever been there?
No, I've heard you talk about it, but I haven't been there.
Okay, so it's at Madison and 36th. Mm-hmm. And its jumping off point is the collection of J.P. Morgan and, you know, the banker.
Yeah, well, right? I'm onto that.
And during the, from about the 1890s through 1906, he spent about $60 million, that would be $900 million, mm-hmm. on art, on his art collection. So it's an interesting museum. I would say it's more for grown-ups. I don't know how much really is going to resonate with young children. It's closed Mondays, open late on Fridays. And it's free on Fridays between 7 and 9, so it's a good place to go. When I hear Morgan Library, I immediately think of my favorite librarian, Belle da Costa Green, who was the librarian for Morgan from, I think, around 1906 until 1948, actually. Mm-hmm. After he died, she continued after he died. She's a fascinating person, absolutely fascinating. And here's why. Number one, she was born Belle Marion Greener. Her father, Richard Greener, was the first black student at Harvard. And he graduated in
1870. Right.
Okay. And first black student, first black graduate.
Right.
And he's an interesting person. He ends up, he has a varied career. For a while, he's dean of the Howard Law School, and he actually he's a diplomat in Siberia at a certain point. And when he gets that appointment, he goes off to Siberia. His wife and children stay home. They move to New York. And for the rest of their lives, they will pass as white. They make that choice and change their names to da Costa Green and kind of reference some kind of Portuguese background. So the whole time Belle is working for
Morgan,
Morgan,
right.
She is passing as white. Mm-hmm. And she's discovered by Junius Morgan's nephew at Princeton. She's working in the Princeton Library.
Mm-hmm.
And she ends up working for Morgan. She is an exotic personality. Mm-hmm. She always says, just because I am a librarian doesn't mean I have to dress like one. Mm-hmm. And she lives a fairly bohemian lifestyle. It's fairly well established that she had a relationship with Bernard Berenson,
mm-hmm.
the famous art historian, and possibly resulting in an abortion. So she is a fascinating person to read about if you're interested. The biography I recommend is called An Illuminated Life by Heidi Ardizzone, and it was written in 2007. So she's interesting, but that's what I think about when I think about the Morgan Library.
All right, so do you want to come back to the...
And we'll come back to some other fascinating characters that come in to my mind because of this exhibition.
Yes, we're breaking it up because this is a substantial museum report. So we're going to take a sideways step to give our latest Broadway report. The Broadway report is we saw another play this week, and it was called Napoli, Brooklyn. Napoli, Brooklyn.
Wasn't the worst play we ever saw. But we have a lot of problems.
Well, Napoli was the story about a family living in Brooklyn in 1960. And it's three daughters, and the father isn't happy putting down tar on the roads. He's kind of frustrated in some way. The mother, who's the most compelling character, is trying to keep it together with the three daughters, who are somewhat rebellious, and the husband, who is marginally abusive, actually. And it's a rough situation, dramatic play. But as Tamsin says, or she implies when she says it's not the worst play we saw, it's not the best play we saw. So it's a play by a woman named Megan Kennedy, who's a young playwright. And the truth is, it's very conventional, which is okay. It's just not particularly compelling. And what's interesting about it, rather than dwell on the fact that we didn't find it compelling, and I can tell you that most people in the audience didn't find it compelling, is that the review is such that it seems pretty clear that nobody's really finding it compelling. The Times review is kind of captures the situation. They say basically, look, you have a young playwright here, and you have a young playwright making basic mistakes. And it actually is an odd review in that the reviewer steps back and says, look, there is a technique that's used. It's called objective correlatives. And they give a little lecture in playwriting. And they say, here's the objective correlatives that this playwright attempts to use and fails to use effectively, as if this is playwriting 101. And oddly, it even attracts a comment in the New York Times Online from a reviewer who reviewed the play when it was at the Long Wharf Theater up there in Connecticut, says the same things. This is a play that got very mixed reviews. All the critics up in Connecticut thought it had obvious needs for fixes, and all of this was ignored. We don't understand why these basic things weren't fixed. And yet, the Times review, which is negative, makes the point of saying, still it's good that Megan Kennedy is aiming so high. I'm reading from the review. Also good is the faith the roundabout has shown in her by commissioning Napoli, Brooklyn, and staging it. That's how you grow playwrights. And that's where I think there's something wrong. I mean, I certainly commend Roundabout for commissioning the play and supporting the playwright, but the idea of putting on a play that you have a very clear idea is not particularly good and it's not going to be well received, I don't think that helps anybody, frankly. Let me contrast the situation with what happened to us immediately after we saw the play. After we saw the play, and we're walking back to the Port Authority, get into the car and go back to Jersey, we happen to walk by the theater, I think it's the Winter Garden, where there's Hello, Dolly, which we saw just the other day.
Schubert.
Oh, it's the Schubert. There you go. The Schubert. Sorry, it's not the Winter Garden. Tamsin always knows where she is. I have to say that. And by accident, or happenstance,
Walking along, we see a big crowd.
It's a big crowd.
It turns out it's a stage door for Hello, Dolly.
Waiting for the actors to step out of Hello, Dolly.
And we're early. And they're coming out.
And they're coming out. And we have a few minutes. We say, what the heck? We just saw this the other day.
It's a lovely evening.
It was a fun production. And we like the actors. So let's see if people actually come out. And there's tremendous enthusiasm there. There's a big crowd. They're very excited. A lot of young people in particular. And sure enough, they come out. But they come out, as it turns out, taking their turns.
It's very dribs and drabs.
State. So you see Kate Baldwin comes out. And after 10 minutes, who comes out? Gavin Creel comes out. And after that, 10 minutes, David Hyde Pierce comes out. And finally, Donna Murphy comes out. And what's interesting about this is that...
We thought we were waiting to see Bette Midler.
Well, that's true, too. We got to Donna Murphy, which is great, but you know, it would have been a bigger reaction for Bette Midler.
I mean, Donna Murphy's really kind of following us around.
Exactly. Yeah. But my point is this. My point is, in each case, there was no accident the way this was done. Each of the actors I just mentioned took 10 or 15 minutes to go around the semicircle of, which was the front row of the people who were standing there to see the group coming out of the stage door, and sign autographs and talk to the group, each of them, did it the same way, 10 or 15 minutes. And as a matter of fact, Gavin Creel, after his stint, hung out with the crowd for 10 or 15 minutes. And of course, you can imagine all these young people, these young girls in particular, going crazy, very excited. And so what's going on there? And you say to yourself, well, they're just such nice actors. And they are. They seem very nice. But it's clear that this is something that's dictated from the top. It's clear that this is the understanding that the people were putting on the play have. It's
okay,
part of the job. But wait a second. But here's what's interesting to me about this. They don't have to promote this play. It's sold out. They're doing this to promote Broadway in the future. That's what that's about. Okay?
Right.
Well, let me tell you how you don't promote Broadway in the future. You don't promote Broadway in the future by putting on plays that you know aren't that good.
And I think you're overreacting.
Maybe.
It was not that bad.
It wasn't that bad.
The acting was actually excellent.
It was good.
Many of the characters were kind of fun and interesting.
Right.
There were nice passages. It just, in the end, didn't quite work. The ending is not compelling. Doesn't quite work. I don't think it was that bad. I think you are
My point
not
is this.
Giving Miss Kennedy a chance.
Now, I don't mean to hammer on this play too much, but I think it was actually...
And yet you are.
Well, I think it was worse than you described.
But
my point is this. My point is you can't take the attitude, well, maybe this wasn't so great, but isn't it great that they're doing this for Broadway? I think it has the opposite effect. I think it makes harder for folks like Roundabout to sell tickets in the future. I think that when you see that the playwright's name in the future, you say, oh no, I saw that play by so-and-so. I don't want to see that playwright again. And it's harder to sell tickets. But that's my own view.
Okay.
Yes, go ahead.
All right, moving right along. So there's a new book out about Nadar. And by Adam Begley, okay? And Nadar was a photographer.
That is the question. Who's Nadar?
Nadar is his nickname. His real name was Gaspard Félix Tournechon. And what's fun about him is that he's the first aerial photographer. He's also is the first aerial postal delivery guy.
Yeah.
He loved balloon travel.
Right.
And remember, in the 19th century, balloons were like airplanes. They were like the next great way to travel.
Right.
It was a big deal. Anyway, it looks like a fun and interesting biography of him. Again, it's by Adam Begley. And what I would recommend to you to do about Nadar is Google Nadar's photograph of Sarah Bernhardt. It is stunning. One of the other things he does besides developing aerial photography is developing that sense of celebrity. Mm-hmm. And he really promotes a lot of interesting people, Baudelaire, Bernhardt, others. He even does a great photograph of Delacroix. But look at the photograph of Bernhardt.
I will say this.
It is stunning. It looks like it could have been taken 20th century.
Oh, yeah. No, it looks like it could have been taken 15 minutes
ago.
It's black and white. But it's not color. But other than that.
And she is ravishing.
Totally contemporary.
And she doesn't look like an old-timey actress from the 19th century. So find that. Google that and take a look.
Yeah, no, Tamsin showed me the photograph. It's too bad we come out, can't communicate that on the podcast, but it is kind of stunning. And he does seem to have an interesting take on photography. Sports, I know we're eager to get to sports. The All-Star Game is coming up on Tuesday. There's not a lot to say
that
about
that. That
would
be baseball.
Baseball, excuse me.
Okay.
I thought that went without saying, but it won't. The baseball All-Star Game is Tuesday. And the Home Run Derby is Monday, for those who are interested in that. But here's what's a little bit off-putting about the All-Star Game. Not a lot. I know I'm sounding a little crabby today. So the All-Star Game is in Miami, the home place of the Miami Marlins. And the Miami Marlins are a problem. More to the point, the Miami Marlins stadium where they're playing the All-Star Game is a problem. And why is that? Because there's a little bit of a swindle that went on at the Miami ballpark. And I expect...
Do tell.
Yeah, I expect that during the broadcast, they'll say once in a while, the controversy. They'll call it the controversy, which is as far as they'll go on network television. So here's the controversy. The Miami team is owned by Jeff Lurie. Jeff Lurie says to the powers that be in Miami several years ago, you know, we'd be doing a lot better here for ourselves and for the city if we had a dome stadium. It gets darn hot in Florida. Who knew? So they say, well, but Dome Stadium, that's expensive. Did you want to build it? And Jeff Lurie says, that's funny. I thought you would build it. And I tell you what, you build it and I'll lease it. But, you know, the only way to make this work economically and for me to stay in the city, frankly, is if you give me a so-called sweetheart lease, less than market rent. So I'm getting the use of the stadium.
Make it worth my while.
Exactly. Make it worth my while. And after back and forth and the political backbiting, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, they do just that. They build the stadium. And what does Jeff Lurie do? What he does is he go out and spend the money on expensive ball players and build a first-class team to go with a first-class stadium? No. He announces he's selling the team. And how is he going to make money when he sells the team? Why, it's the value of the sweetheart lease. So the team, which might have been worth and by quite a bit, let's call it $800 million, let's call it close to $1 billion before, is now going to be worth $400 million more than otherwise would be worth, and that will go in the pocket of Jeff Lurie, the value given to him by the brethren who run Miami. So there's a lot of bitter feelings.
Brethren?
I'm sorry. The town fathers. But there's a lot of bitterness about Lurie, about that stadium, and that's where they're playing the All-Star game, and that happens. That happens in baseball. That's been a so-called controversy for years and will continue to be a controversy. And it's too bad. The other thing I wanted to mention having to do with sports is the passing of Gene Conley. Gene Conley did something that will never be done again and that even Michael Jordan couldn't do. And what Gene Conley did is he succeeded as a professional baseball player and a professional basketball player simultaneously. And what do I mean by that? Gene Conley won a world championship, or was a member of the world championship Milwaukee Braves in 1957. At the same time, he was winning three NBA titles with the Boston Celtics from 1958 to 1961. He played 18 professional seasons in 12 years. In six consecutive years, his baseball and basketball careers overlapped. That meant that he played 154, or participated in a season of 154 baseball games and a basketball season of 81 basketball games all in the same year. And he did that for six consecutive years. He's the only one to do anything like that. Michael Jordan, as you may recall, couldn't quite pull that off. Michael Jordan, obviously, super, super basketball player, left basketball at one point to concentrate on trying to make it as a baseball player, lasted a year in the minor league system for the Chicago White Sox, and failed and went back to basketball.
So why will it never happen again? Why could he do it?
That's the question. Here's the answer. The answer is not because Conley was the greatest basketball and baseball player of all time. It's because he wasn't. He was mediocre. And that's why he was able to do what he did. And here's what I mean. He couldn't make a living at either sport independently without having to do the other sport. Now, he was helped quite a bit by the fact that they paid very poorly in those days, both baseball players.
So he had a financial incentive.
He had a financial incentive that Michael Jordan didn't have. So to give you an example, 1952-53 season, when playing professional basketball, he earned $4,500. For that entire season. Later on, as he had some more success, he actually went to the baseball team and said, look, if you paid me a certain amount of money, I just won't do the basketball. I know you'd feel better about it, and I won't do it, and that'll be great. And they said, how about $20,000? They said, well, how about a little more than that? And they said, no. And then he played. So the way the economics were then, it's set up for someone like Conley. Nice contrast to me, and I should mention, you hear about two sports stars, but it's not those two sports. It's football, which doesn't pay near as much, and baseball, like Bo Jackson, right? It's not basketball and baseball. The only exception, Dave DeBuscher, but he only did it for like 1 year, and he became too successful a basketball player. The more recent example that might have been, you may remember, Tamsin, Chris Young went to Princeton a little bit after we were there. And he was a guy who was considered a huge prospect in both, 6'9". And he left school after 2 years, where he was an all-Ivy basketball player, to play professional baseball. But he did not try to make it as a professional basketball player simultaneously. And here's the economic point. Chris Young spent 13 years in the major leagues, okay? You probably aren't highly aware of his career. His career record is 79-67. But here's what's interesting. Over the total of that career, he has earned close to $20 million. Okay, and he's a very average baseball player.
Conley.
So the financial incentives aren't there. Gene Conley will stand alone.
But, you know, you said because he was mediocre. We just have to find more mediocre guys. Maybe they could do it.
The problem is that the mediocre level is going down, down, down. There are guys in the NBA who are so-called mediocre who are making $4 or $5 million a year. So you got to look fast because it's getting harder and harder to find someone who's a candidate to do just that. Okay, so we saw a movie this week. Just a few days ago, and we saw a movie, and last Monday. And the movie that we previewed.
That's what we call a week ago.
Baby Driver.
Baby Driver.
Baby Driver.
You were all excited about it.
I was excited about it. We had read this great review in the Times. And it pretty much was as advertised. I think it was. It's a movie about a getaway driver whose name is Baby. And it is a car chase movie. Fair enough? It was just maybe a little bit more.
Highly choreographed.
Yes.
And music is important.
Right.
So it worked for us because, you know, we don't go to a lot of car chase movies.
Right.
But this one worked.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right. It was virtuosic filmmaking, if we can call it that. It was brilliant filmmaking. And everything was syncopated. The music was syncopated with what was going on the screen, these car chases, these long shots, these editing. It really brought you in a very visceral fashion. The main character, Ansel Elgort, is the name of the actor who played
Baby.
And he's great, and he's perfect, and he flows through the movie. He's on the beat, sometimes spectacularly so. I mean, the rest of the movie is kind of ordinary in some respects, and I think I'll go with Manolo Dorcas 100% on this. When Manolo Dorcas said, the movie's so good, you wish it could be better. And I think that's true, but that's a lot to ask. As a summer movie, it's great, and more important, speaking for our demographic, can you go to a car chase movie and enjoy it? I think our answer is yes.
Yes, the violence, there was violence,
yeah.
But it's kind of over the top. It's pretty cartoonish.
That's right.
So you can sort of deal with it. I would just like to say that some of the music is syncopated, but I think mainly it's synchronized with the action.
Oh, okay.
Is what we would say.
You're absolutely right. That's the right word.
And I know they worked very hard on that, and it's remarkable, the timing of all these chases and the heists themselves. It's just visually compelling.
Yeah, compelling is the right word. I think that's right.
So back to Henry James and American Painting. And this is an exhibition that really tries to set out the connection between Henry James, the writer, and he actually wrote some art criticism, and his connection with various painters, including John Singer Sargent and others, and his sort of coaxing them along, helping them in their careers, and what these various connections were. And it's kind of an interesting look at painters and writers. And it actually was co-curated by Cullum Tobin, the writer, which is pretty interesting.
Who wrote Brooklyn.
Who wrote
Brooklyn.
Last year. Yeah. And he also wrote a book called The Master, which is the story of Henry James and a young artist, Hendrik Christian Andersen, young when Henry knew him, and he was an expatriate sculptor in Rome, and allegedly he and Henry James had a relationship, and there's some rather steamy letters that still exist that have been published that tell the story of this relationship. Hendrik Christian Andersen was a pretty interesting guy, and for a couple of different reasons. Well, maybe at least three different reasons. And one was the letters, his relationship with Henry James. And that's what a lot of people know him for. And that's the subject of Tobin's book, and it's a great book, The Master. I recommend reading it. But also, and he was an over-the-top sculptor of massive nude figures in a somewhat neoclassical style. But he also actually was a city planner. Okay, he was born in Norway. He comes over to the U.S. He grows up in Newport, Rhode Island, on the docks, impoverished. He comes in contact with all these other sophisticated, wealthy, educated people. And he's an autodidact. He teaches himself everything he knows, basically. But he is always envious of the wealthy who have all this access to knowledge and education. And even in his relationship with Henry James, he feels a little left out. He seems to have been basically James's boy toy. And James has a lot of sophisticated intellectual friends also, you know, around Anderson's age, but he never brings those two groups together. Anderson is kind of treated as, you know, a bright but not too educated, fluent guy. And that upsets him. And he dreams of a world where he could have access to the knowledge and have access to all this culture. So he designs it. And it's called the World Center for Communication. He publishes it in a giant book in 1913. It has subways. This world city has subways. It has kind of general heating for everybody. It has baseball diamonds. It has gymnasiums. It has a lot of things that were amazing to conceive of in a planned city in 1913. So that's kind of fun. This is all on view in the Museo Anderson in Rome, which is a fun place to go. Now, one other person involved in this conversation is Eugene Sandow. And the reason I say that is because Anderson's aesthetic for the nude male figure is a little bit over the top.
Yeah, well, let me jump in here because I've been to the Museo Anderson.
Right.
Okay. So I think the key phrase you used was massive nude figures. Was that your phrase?
Yes. It was super muscular.
Yeah.
Hyper muscular. Okay, so, but even more so, I mean...
Let me give you the layman's perspective. The layman's perspective is they're like Marvel superheroes, but they forgot the costume. And they're also...
That's an excellent point because in my mind, Anderson is the guy, I mean, who latches on to this 20th century aesthetic that will become the superhero body type.
Right.
But where does he get it?
Eugene Sandow.
Eugene Sandow.
Exactly.
The father of modern bodybuilding.
Right.
Okay. So he is a fun guy.
Right.
And you've got, if you want to Google something else, Google the YouTube Thomas Edison made films of him.
Of Eugene Sandow.
Yeah, in the 1890s.
Right, with his clothes on, though, I think.
With his clothes on, you know, posing. Yeah. Sandow was, a strongman. And Flo Ziegfeld hired him to be at the Chicago
first,
World's
the
Fair.
The first Arnold Schwarzenegger, basically.
Well, Ziegfeld was noticing that while people were impressed with him bending the bars and lifting up great amounts, what they really enjoyed was his posing. Okay, so he encouraged him to, you know, choreograph more and more of the posing. He was, you know, tremendously popular. Women and men would pay extra after the show to come meet him and feel his muscles. And he sold photographs of himself. He maintained that he developed his body. He kind of crafted his body type by looking at sculptures of ancient the famous ancient Greek sculptures,
right.
Like a dying Gaul.
Right.
And so he actually posed
right.
with a fig leaf.
So it's art imitating life, right. imitating
he
art.
He poses right, yeah. with a fig leaf, imitating these right. sculptures. Right. And in fact, the British Museum actually did a life cast of him
yeah.
because his body was supposed to be so perfect.
Right.
All right. But here's the other fun thing. He actually had a chain of gymnasiums.
Right.
The Sandow's Institutes of Culture. In about 1906 in London, he had 20 of them
yeah.
for men and women.
Right.
They had
that's not so
Oriental
strange.
Rugs. Yeah. They had music playing. They were all the rage. Everybody was
right.
going to the gym in 1906.
They still are.
So he's an interesting guy. Eugene Sandow, look him up. Google him as well. So, so this exhibition that involves Henry James and a cast of characters, including Hendrik Christian Andersen, brings all these
yeah,
fun
so
things to mind.
I'll just say the Museo Andersen, I mean, is stunning in that it's this collection of these huge, they're not even, I was going to say lifelike, but they're like 10 feet tall. And these huge
larger than life.
Larger than life, Marvel-like figures. And they're all collected there because other museums don't really exhibit it, I think. Is that right? I mean, it's not like you can go to the Met and see Andersen.
To be perfectly frank, he actually designs this world city
yeah.
because he can't find anywhere to put his sculpture.
Right, right, right.
And so the idea is that he would sell this plan
right.
to somebody. Mussolini seems somewhat interested,
right.
Frankly. He never manages to quite sell it to anybody, but that was part of the idea.
Yeah.
So, what do we got? What else do we have today besides the Morgan?
Well, we just have a science report, and the science report is both the lack of science and the concentration on science. One is has to do with the Mets. The Mets. Are usually behind the curve science-wise, sadly. They're behind the curve baseball-wise also, so it's kind of a sad state of affairs. There was just an odd article in the Times about the Mets in that Cespedes, their slugger, who's having a somewhat disappointing season interrupted by soft tissue injury, has now been introduced to the thought that he should drink a lot of water. He's been cramping up and developing strains in his hamstring and the like, and they say water... You know, staying hydrated is key to that. And the Cespedes says, you know, I haven't to this point been a big water drinker. But since I got hurt, I'm starting to drink more water. Maybe it will help.
How does he get away with this for all this time?
It's crazy. It's insane.
People have been promoting drinking water crazy.
The article goes on and it says, you know, a lot of people have been noticing hydrating is a good thing in terms of avoiding pulled muscles and the like, as if this is news. And the Cespedes is saying, yeah, I kind of like water. I heard something like that. Maybe I'll take a shot at that. So it's just... mind-boggling. Only in Metsville the things like this happen. There are no words. But in any event, look for a second half improvement from the Mets because Cespedes is carrying around a water bottle.
And you contrasted this with
an article by Dr. Eric Topol in the Wall Street Journal about tools to improve care and reduce cost. And this is an interesting article. He's a cardiologist, but he's also involved in a lot of initiatives in terms of use of advanced medical equipment. And he does note, as everybody's noting these days, as we have the huge debate about Obamacare and what may or may not replace it, is that medical costs are increasing on a steep curve. It's uncontrollable. How are we going to pay these going forward? And he makes a pretty simple, contained, but what I think is a vital observation. And that is a lot of the money for medical costs has to do with testing. For example, there are 125 million ultrasound scans a year, and that costs $100 billion. And he makes the point that, in fact, we now have ultrasound probes that connect with a smartphone that provide resolution comparable to hospital lab machines. In other words, with your smartphone, you could do the same examination, do the same ultrasound test.
That doesn't seem possible.
It does. He also notes the FDA has already approved wearable sensors that can continuously monitor all vital signs. blood pressure, heart rate, and rhythm, body temperature, breathing rate, and oxygen concentration in the blood. To give you an example of the testing, now, admittedly, he's a doctor, okay? He says he noticed that he had, as he described it, a pain in his flank. He took out his smartphone. He did the kind of ultrasound thing that he says you could do with your smartphone, and he found that he had a kidney stone. He diagnosed himself, a kidney stone, with his smartphone. And just to connect the dots, he went to the hospital and did an official hospital test, and they found the exact same thing.
That he was correct.
He was correct. It cost $2,200 in the hospital. He had to spend the time for a hospital visit. And he said, gee, this is something that you can do at home. I certainly, as a doctor, do it at home, but others could learn to do it at home. But this is, you know, for the future. And it does seem very promising that you could use technology in smartphones, which are going to become even more sophisticated in the future, to do a lot of self-testing and monitoring.
Because these costs are outrageous.
They are outrageous.
You had a recent experience with your dad.
Right. The recent experience with my dad is, all right, my dad's 95 years old. So my dad, it happens to be in a medical facility, which is by the hospital that he goes to when he has problems. And in any event, he has some trouble going up a ramp. He's with an aide, but he's short of breath. So he calls his doctor.
Long story short is this.
What the doctor says, listen, you should, if you're feeling short of breath or uncomfortable, check into the hospital. And he does. And what results is 3 or 4 days of intense testing. And he's uncomfortable the whole time. He's ready to go home. He leaves after 3 or 4 days. They say, we didn't find anything.
They won't let him leave.
They won't let him leave. And after all the testing, they say, all right, we did all the testing. We understand you're feeling tired. We know what the problem is. The problem is you're 95 years old. And then 2 days later, he gets the bill. The bill is $55,000. And, it's covered by insurance, which, of course, is the problem.
But it's still outrageous.
It's an outrage. They have a copay for him of $1,500. He's not paying the $1,500. Good luck to these folks trying to get that $1,500 from my father. And maybe they won't care. But the point is, a so-called frictionless medical system where, the money gets automatically paid and nobody thinks about it isn't necessarily a good thing. The frictionless system supports the $55,000 charge. Whether that charge was run up because the hospital saw a chance to make money or they were being ultra cautious or what, I don't know. I suggest it's a combination of the two, particularly the first. And you can't have that. But one way is to pull the testing out of the hospital. And you see that yourself. You now go to blood testing that's outside of a hospital. But now we're talking about testing that might be done with your own smartphone. And on top of that, where the patient is in control of the patient's own medical information.
Yeah, but I mean, there's still more work to be done. Self-diagnosis is kind of a slippery slope.
Well, no.
Even if Mr. Smartphone helps you.
Well, okay? It's nice to have the data, and maybe you can skip a few tests and you go to the doctor and send them the data.
I certainly hope so.
Okay, so we end today with a new feature. In our podcast. We have a roving reporter. We have Armin Evers. Man on the street. Man behind the bar at Deanna's, where we go regularly. An astute observer of the scene has, in connection with the 4th of July, has visited there and filed a report on the hot dog eating contest at Coney Island.
And here's Armand.
Well, I'm standing at the corner of Surf and Stillwell Avenue in Coney Island, 4th of July and a hot sunny day, after the conclusion of the 101st Nathan's Coney Island Hot Dog Eating Championship. Joey Chestnut, the male winner at 72, a record for the Nathan's contest of 72 hot dogs in 10 minutes. I'll tell you, it doesn't get much more red, white, and blue than this. This is just, I know you talk about plays and art exhibits, and this is something else. There had to be about 30,000 people hanging in the sun, elbow to elbow. The great George Shea introducing everybody, entertaining people with a choir singing Bon Jovi songs and rap rap artists and dancers and break dancers and even an opera singer. Got the hairs on the back of my neck going. So anyway, something to plan for next year. Take it off your bucket list. For Tamsin and Dan, read the paper. This is Armand Evers in Coney Island. From David's Famous, from Smithfield, from the Cyclone, the Wonder Wheel, the Freak Show, from Coney
Island, from the Cosmos, from the United States of America. Okay, so that's all for today. Thank you, Armand.
And thanks for listening to Tamsin and Dan, read the paper.